Good morning. I'll convene the House Education Finance Committee. And thank you all for sticking with us on a Friday. With that, we have a quorum, so we'll move to the minutes. Representative Jordan, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have looked at the minutes from March 16th, 2023, and I move their approval, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Are there any questions from members on the minutes for March? Now I lost my spot. 16th. I just have to start highlighting that so I see that. Any questions on the minutes for March 16th? All right, there we go. Any questions?
Nope,
not good enough.
I think move it higher.
Higher like this? Does that work? Any no questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? No. The minutes for March 16th are adopted, and I guess I'm just going to be shouting all hearing. Please take no offense, anybody. With that, we have our first bill ahead of us. Here is House File 2320. Representative Pryor, could you please move the House File 2320 before the committee?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. And welcome, Chair Pinto, to the House Education Finance Committee. I see you have an A7 amendment. So, Representative Pryor, could you also please move the A7 amendment?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. With that, members, we have the A7 amendment before us. Representative Pinto, will you please briefly describe the A7 amendment?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Yeah, thank you. And thanks, members. The A7 addresses a couple of issues that have come up since the bill was first introduced, as is often the case. I will maybe just highlight, there's several things. There's a transition report to the legislature on page 2, some issues relating to data practices on page 3, but I think the stuff that's most relevant to this committee is some language on page 1 and leading into page 2 that just reassure that employees who transfer to the new department have no changes to their jobs, employment status and job classification and a variety of other protections to make sure that employees are in good shape with regard to the change.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. With that, any questions on the A7 amendment? Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto, on the author's amendment. And I know we're going to have a lot of discussion about this. As I look at this in the first couple of things, here's my concerns. I'll just throw this out there. What we're about to do is recreate and re-engineer and do a whole lot of replanning for things. And what we're already putting in place here is we're saying, well, we're not going to allow or we're not going to change or we're going to protect people's job classifications and status. And just coldly, sometimes we need to change those. We need to change people. We need to change ideas. We need to change personnel. And I understand why we would do this. I understand the protections. But frankly, I'll just say if we're going to do this, we need to be able to have the flexibility to redo things and to move some people in, some people out. And so, you know, the amendment's going to go on all that, but I would just say right off the bat, that's one of my concerns is if we're going to do this and not be allowed to recreate and have some freedom, I think that will tie our hands for getting to the final goal. So I'll just add it to that way.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Crescia. I guess what I'll say is that you know, however our state's laws work regarding, you know, striking the balance between changes in employment and structure and providing protections for employees, the key thing is we want to make sure that the change in agencies is not, that's separate from those laws. So what we want to do is, I guess to the extent that anybody would be viewing the change of agencies as being somehow preempting or getting past protections for employees, we certainly would not want that to happen. And that's what this language is about.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. With that, members, all those in favor of the A7 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. The A7 amendment's adopted. With that, Representative Pinto, go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Joachim, and thanks, members. So I'm so excited to be with you today to present a proposal for a new Department of Children, Youth, and Families. This is a proposal that's coming from the Walz Flanagan administration. You're going to hear from Assistant Commissioner Bailey in a second. But it's really something that is, as you'll hear too, is a number of years in coming, and a number of us have worked on ideas relating to this. And so in particular, there was a proposal for Department of Early Childhood that had a lot of discussion in this committee, in fact, and passed through this committee last term. But I'm really excited for the opportunity. I think it probably makes sense, Chair, to simply have us dive into receiving the presentation from the administration. I know there'll be a lot of discussion, but thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. With that, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Joachim and members of the committee. My name is Erin Bailey, and I have the privilege of serving as Executive Director of Minnesota's Children's Cabinet. The Children's Cabinet, housed within Minnesota Management and Budget, refers to the state's convening of commissioners around children and youth. I'm excited to be here today to present the Walls Flanagan proposal to create a new cabinet-level Department of Children, Youth, and Families through a transition process with dedicated time, capacity, and resources. The proposal reimagines state government by providing an opportunity to better center children in our systems. I'm presenting here today. I'm presenting here today with Bobby Burnham, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education. Along with Children's Cabinet leaders from across the enterprise, we have co-led the decision to propose this child-centered agency and developed a proposed scope and transition plan and office. Our presentation will include background overview of the history and a proposal to fund and create this transition office. I'll just start by saying we are excited about the moment we are in, what is possible, and we truly believe that if we want different results, we need to do things differently. The why behind this proposal is the 1.4 million children who live in our state. One third of these children live in lower income families. Children are the most racially diverse age group in our state. One third of all children in our state are Black, Indigenous, or children of color. And about 11% of children under the age of 18 in Minnesota have been identified as having a disability. Yet we do not have a cabinet-level agency who has a job of focusing on children. These programs and systems that support them exist within other structures with competing priorities. Yet there are priority, there are future. And as you know, our overall well-being as a state depends on the success of our youngest Minnesotans. For years and in some cases decades, we have heard the early childhood community needs a dedicated agency. We've heard that some agencies are too big. We've heard that youth need a clearer voice. Families, local service providers, and educators have been asking for coordination, engagement, and culturally responsive programs that meet their needs throughout development. The administration has truly doubled down on this work, listening, learning, and leveraging its leaders. And with these learnings from governance reports, from OLA reports, cross-agency work, and other states, the case for alignment, additional alignment, is clear. It's time for Minnesota to create an agency centered on children, similar to the governance structure of more than half the states in the country. There is history to build off of and learn from here in our state in Minnesota. In 1995, the legislature established the Department of Children, Families, and Learning. The department was created to replace the Department of Education with a broader focus and encompass the K-12 education in its scope. In 2003, the Department of Education was reestablished and other programs were distributed back to home agencies. Challenges were continued to be lifted up by families, by communities, and in 2010, a task force recommended a cabinet-level office. The Office of Early Learning was created. There are learnings from the story. The proposal before you is different, and it is more in line with states across the country, including successes in the last several years. Over the last 4 years, our state has relaunched a robust, action-oriented children's cabinet focused from prenatal to young adulthood with a number of interagency teams that are driving coordination and problem-solving. We received the Federal Preschool Development Grant, which began with robust engagement process to develop family-informed statewide early childhood strategic plan. These efforts and more have built for this moment of now. With feedback and partnerships and strong alignment across our leadership in the state to move along a more coordinated continuum as other states. Related to governance, I'll touch on this just real briefly. There are three models: a consolidation into new agencies, consolidations into existing agencies, or coordination. States are in the process of moving to more child-focused consolidated agencies. Several states are now currently in the process, and you'll see here on the map, and it's about 22 that have an alignment similar to what we're proposing here today. The MAD governance report that was issued last year was clear about what a state needs to do to create a successful governance change. You need planning with dedicated staff, resources, and time. You need to engage your leaders and secure their buy-in, and you need to determine the funding and resources needed. Considering this, we put together this proposal for the new department with a transition process and timeline that provides the resources, time to and to adapt with all of you as more information is learned. I will transition to the proposal. I alluded to the why. The governor and lieutenant governor proposing this new structure is really about creating a recognizable public face and a clear front door in our state's quest to prioritize children. Increased opportunities to maximize and coordinate funding, to align outcomes and convene leadership, and to sharpen the focus of our current agencies. In accomplishing this why, our leaders agreed to hold principles related to a whole family approach, to consolidate early childhood programs, to ease access to improve equitable outcomes. The language directs the transfer of core programs between July 1 of 2024 and July 1 of 2025. It is not all immediate on day one. Thought and readiness was considered in the core programs listed in the legislation. The core of this proposal is an elevation of Children and Family Services at DHS. The proposal then consolidates other programs, including those within the Early Learning Services Division and the After School Grant Program at the Department of Education. And the bill language and existing authorities allow for adjustments and changes to these core programs. The focus of the bill funds an implementation team and transition fund, obtaining authority and resources to support the creation, alignment, and launch of a two-year process of moving core programs to the new agency. The transition office will be established on July 1 of this year and will be responsible for leading the establishment of the new department, planning for the transition programs to it, including elements related to budget, finance, legal, human resources, and much more. The director and staff of the implementation office will build on ongoing work to develop and execute a plan for successful creation of the agency. This will include robust engagement as well as reporting back to all of you. Funding for the office and two-year transition work includes the transition team, funds for one-time setup of funds analysis, engagement and implementation processes, and execution of knowledge transfer. For reference, here are the programs named to transfer from DHS. This includes, as I said, the entire Children and Family Services Department, with an exception of a certain housing grant program and administration of those grants. The proposal includes licensing and program integrity functions from the Office of Inspector General at the Department of Human Services. From education, the programs moving are all those under the Early Learning Services Division, as well as the after-school grant program that is in statute but is not currently funded. I'll note the governor has proposed $45 million to reestablish the program, which would be available through fiscal year 2027. A full list of the named programs recommended for transfer from MDE is in Section 15, Subdivision 3 of the bill. We also propose moving the Youth Justice Office from the Department of Public Safety. I'll end by stating the obvious. This proposal seeks to answer questions and feedback heard for many, many years. In order to do it right, we need a robust engagement process. We need more specific discussions with families, with local service providers, including schools, tribes, counties, and others. And the way to do that is through dedicated time and capacity. And that time is now. We have a network of leaders who are ready, who believe that this is necessary, and believe that the exercise is important. I'll now pass it over to Assistant Commissioner Burnham to speak about the impact of the proposal.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Chair, committee members, my name is Bobby Burnham, and I am the Assistant Commissioner of the Office of Teaching and Learning at the Department of Education. After years of working inside and outside of government, mostly focused on the goal to ensure coordination and access to early care and early learning programs that support successful transitions into the K-12 system, I am thrilled we are at this point of proposing this child-focused agency. Through recent efforts funded by the legislature and administrative efforts like the Race to the Top grant, the Early Childhood Systems Reform effort, the OLA report on early childhood, and most recently the work of the Children's Cabinet and Preschool Development Grant, the state has made significant progress in coordinating and aligning early childhood programs and heard the needs related to this governance shift. Through these efforts and engagement, we believe in building on our progress by consolidating early childhood programs to drive results and improve outcomes for children, families, and the workforce, improve coordination for providers, align funding prioritization and a common application or front door for families. Continuing to engage our community members, educators, and program administrators in this process and the transition. I want to acknowledge that we, as well as many of you, have received feedback from our early childhood special education partners regarding the transition of Part C services. Part C is listed as a core service that would move to the new agency under this proposal. This would change the state level lead agency responsible for the state level administration of Part C from the Department of Education to the new proposed Department of Children, Youth, and Families. This does not change Part C administration at the district or local level. We are not proposing any changes to how these services are currently delivered or who delivers them. Creating a new state agency with the purpose of better aligning programs will not change a district's collective bargaining agreements, and there is no proposed language that would change who is defined as a service provider. We have done additional engagement with our ECSE partners and workforce and created a Part C FAQ that has helped, and we look forward to more engagement with the workforce and others. We've made significant progress to better coordination in our early childhood system, and we believe shifting governance of programs will build on that progress. Specifically, the Department of Children, Youth, and Families will enable the creation of a sustainable central state vision to ensure Minnesota's families are able to reach their full potential. This will prioritize our children in our structure and coordination, including with MDE, will continue. The agency can provide the leadership and coordination needed to support children and families by valuing and implementing research-backed multi-generation approaches, coordinated implementation of unified statewide networks of community resource centers, prioritizing youth with leadership, and creating an agency that focuses upstream with youth. We must act boldly at this moment, learning from years of engagement, research in other states, because our state depends on the success of Minnesota children, youth, and families. The creation of the new Children, Youth, and Families Agency can help achieve a clear front door and recognizable public face, improved communication focused on children and families, coordinated and maximized funding, aligned outcomes, and improved access to services. And we have a plan to take time, do it right, and continue to listen and engage with agency, staff, experts, school leaders, and educators, our tribal and county partners, and families. Thank you. We are eager to answer your questions today and happy to connect individually to discuss this proposal and opportunity further.
Thank you so much. Next up, we have Tiffany O'Neill Walker. Thank you for joining us. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
I'm Tiffany O'Neill Walker. I'm a St. Paul parent. Now I'll read. Hello, and thank you everyone for having me. My name is Tiffany O'Neill Walker, and I'm a parent to 4 adults and 2 small kids, and I'm also a parent leader with Kids Count on Us. I'm going to try my best to keep my composure today because the subject is very close to my heart. So please excuse me if I break up a little bit. Our youngest child was a foster to permanent placement. And he attends a child care center that we absolutely adore in St. Paul. And I'm here today to share my story as someone who is fully supportive, especially after hearing the ins and outs and the outline of how it's going to be done, of creating a Department of Youth, Children, and Families so that all families, including families like and unlike mine, can have the resources and attention we need during one of the toughest parts to navigate of our lives. our family's sudden and extremely mentally trying experience was being thrust into the foster care system and also the licensing process. We were not previous foster parents. We became licensed due to a kinship issue with one of our family members. Not only were we caring for a new precious baby boy with extra medical needs, we were navigating licensing classes, home visits, and a myriad of other services, hospital stays, you name it, we had a lot going on. I'm pretty sure that we only ate pizza every night for dinner, as I barely held it all together. And I'm sure there's others in this room when I say to that mentally trying extreme, a lot of you can relate. At the same time, we lost my mother's ability to provide any childcare for our family due to her deteriorating health. I was jumping from St. Joseph's Hospital to Children's Hospital to be with my mother as she was on life support for over a month, and to be with a baby that we were taking on and prepared to love for the rest of his life if need be. I was so fearful of finding the right center to nurture this baby that was going to be in our care because we had only experienced care from my mother. I was stressed about what the costs were going to be because the reality is the DHS compensation that we were receiving was not slated to cover everything that I knew was lying ahead. And I wasn't sure how I was going to balance everything and still maintain my full-time employment that we needed to make my family's budget work. Through some very fortunate, lucky, divine, I like to say, circumstances, we found an amazing child care center. Our director, Deborah Messinger, at All Ages and Faces, is way more than an administrator. Not only does she run the center, she helps us and other families navigate incredibly confusing maze of childcare and preschool benefits. She deserves triple her salary just for helping us figure out how to afford childcare. But that shouldn't have to be her job when she's there to run the center and give our kids the education they need, the foundation of education principles that they need in those extremely formative years. If we had a department with streamlined childcare and preschool resources where both families and providers could get their needs met, she could focus even more on providing the high quality care that we know our young children deserve. And I know her situation isn't unique, every director. Every day that I drop my little one off at childcare, he's now four, by the way, almost four, and thriving, I feel like I am dropping him at my mother's house. That is the level of love and care and concern and nourishment that our child care workers and directors provide to our kids. They deserve to be paid so much more, I tell them every day. They're doing one of the most important jobs there is. Our kids are our priceless assets and future. And getting them and keeping them caught up at an early age, especially when they're born at a disadvantage, born addicted like ours was, where you're looking out for health issues, you're looking out for developmental issues, you're looking out for behavior issues. I don't understand, and I'm not going to sit here and try to understand and pretend to understand all the inner workings of what this means for you all in our state government or agencies, but I do have a unique perspective as having navigated both the foster care system and the child care benefits system. I know my family would have benefited greatly, and it would have been a tremendous stress off my shoulders to have a little more help and guidance that this new department could provide during that time of our lives. I also know, especially from listening to today's presentation, and especially just from using my own logic, it makes sense to have one state department, one main state department, focused on our young kids, youth, and families. I'm fully on board with the government working for and with families to actually make this the best state in the nation for our kids and our families. Creating a department of children, youth, and families is necessary to make that a reality. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your personal story. Members, I forgot when we made the motion that the motion is going to be to vote and then we refer to the Children's and Families Committee. So with that, we have one person signed up for public testimony. If you would like to approach, state your name for the record and then proceed.
So I would like, my name is Saslin Tiemenson. So I got like a very cool thing figured out. Okay, so I took a very deep analysis bill reading on this. Number one, before we start off, this means a lot to me, especially as an immigrant adopted from Russia, and especially being through the foster system and then being adopted again to another family in Wisconsin. It was like it took a lot of havoc. So it took some time, and it was kind of a... When overall, like with reading of it, I think it's there's some parts of it I took out of it. Well, I just have a little bit of questions on. So, for instance, when we look at with the duties and the jobs, I think of the bill, we look at the 12 section 12.22, family services and community-based collaborative community-based. To me, I would think that would fall under like human services, and I think with from other instances is from 13.1111, which is diversity work program. I also think that should be part of Department of Labor because multiple, I'm not going to read quite just those two instances. There's more that I highlighted. I think there's got to be a proper review of the bill and certain job stipulations, certain job criteria, because I think a lot of them can fall under in the same departments. Because this brings me to the price tag and the fiscal responsibility of it. So within the bill, you have $5 million of being appropriated under 2024. So the question then is, within that bill, I would think that it's important that we designate of how many staff members are needed. And if so, what is the criteria of those staff members? Are they going to be allocated from the departments of health and services? Are they going to be allocated? And if so, will their salaries also be transferred over, which would equal into allocation of their funds? And then the other question is that, well, you have the $5 million, but where is it all going? You know, like, for instance, what is the exact line-by-line item thing? Because you can't just slap in $5 million. Oh, cool. Well, anyone that reads a bill, especially if I was in D.C. last week, they're very strict on making sure, like, line by line, especially reading the big budget that was $1.8 trillion. That took me about 4,000 pages. It took me quite some time to read, 5 days to read the whole thing. And the thing is that they had an expenditure. They had an exact listing of what's going to cost, and I think that needs to be addressed in there. And then will the department need extra allocations of funds if it were to exceed over $5 million? And if so, where would those allocations come from? Because we see that the Budget Finance Committee will be allocating, and then we also see another $2.3 million will be allocated from the budget and planning. I think that's a little bit excessive because of $2.3 million. I know it has, like, within the line item B, it has, like, with appropriation of, for instance, research and analysis. Well, the question is, what is there else to research and analysis? You know, what can't the department of this new committee, can't they go to the Department of Health Services? Can't they go to the Department of Education, Public Safety, and get analysis from them? Are they doing a field study? Are they doing – see, there's a lot of gray area within this. And this is what I was just kind of talking about. And I was with the governor of Virginia, and we kind of broke down this bill as well. And so he's like, it's just a little bit confusing, and it's a lot of gray area. and it's a lot up open for interpretation. So the other, so the big question is how come the $2.3 million is already being allocated without figuring out the total cost of the $5 million? So why is already the allocated of $2.3 million when you haven't used up the $5 million? So where's, what is the purpose of the 2.3? Because I understand if we go over budget, okay, we need to take some money. So where's, what is the expense of the 2.3? And why the, you know, why do we need extra on top of it? It's just, I mean, that's one of the questions I have, because I'm a budget person. I love money. And if you do a check register, if you do like any finance, you, if something is off, then you're like, okay, maybe I have to take out a loan, but I've already got set budget. So 2.3, and I think that there also needs to be a also a line by line item. And then if it were to go over budget, if you were to go over 2.3 million and 5 million, where else would the funds come out of if it were to go over allocated funds? Would there be a special, would there be a special hearing? Would there be special, would there be, like the governor have to allocate more and do an executive order to continue the funding? So I did my homework. And right now, the Department of Human Services has a $1.5 billion budget. The Department of Education has a $353 million budget. And the Department of Safety. So that is, right now.
So, Susan Temison, thank you so much for your testimony. But we have more work to do on this bill. And there's other committee stops, and we have limited time. Some of your questions sound like they could be addressed offline, what we call offline, with the author of the bill. But we appreciate your testimony.
Well, I think
did you want to just wrap it up in a
yeah,
few
well,
sentences? That would be great.
Absolutely. Well, I think a lot of it has to do, I think this is personally, I think this is not a very, I think there's got to be taking it back and go back to the drawing board to get more of a proper proper adjusting and proper terminology. And maybe it's, maybe if you have to like go through it again and then add more of a line by line item, that'd be more of, I think that'd be equal to a proper transparency. And that's pretty much it.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you.
Representative Pinto, did you have any final comments before we go to, not final comments, but comments before we go to the table?
No, I think we can go to member discussion. Thank you.
All right. Representative Altendorf. Sorry, Representative Knudsen. I was looking at the name tag and you.
That's okay. She's usually on the end, but we're good. Thank you, Representative, or thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. I think that our last testifier did bring up some good points. Can you explain to us how you got to that $5 million for the 2024? Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. So this is slightly awkward timing because the governor released a supplemental budget just yesterday, and so there'll be some updated numbers. I will note that the budget for this, assuming that it advances, will be out of the Children and Families Committee. So I'm happy, to the extent the chair wants the question answered, to talk about sort of how that original number was calculated. But again, it's actually, I think, as changing as a result of supplemental budget numbers released yesterday. So it probably makes more sense to talk about kind of what the current numbers are as part of that, if that makes sense.
Thank you. Representative
Altman,
follow-up?
Knudsen. Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair.
In the wrong place.
Right. I know. She's usually on the end. thank you, Madam Chair. thank you, Representative Pinto. No, that's it for now. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Pinto, maybe quickly, too. I've looked over the accounts that are changing or the people that are moving. Do you want to maybe briefly focus on what actually is coming out of MDE that's within our budget that we're talking about today?
Great point, Madam Chair. Yeah, so members, and one thing probably it's important to recognize, so the proposal, what it really is it's Children and Family Services from Department of Human Services. Essentially, that whole division, with a couple exceptions, moves over, and that's the bulk of the new agency. From MDE, then, it's the early learning programs. I don't know if the name of that department, but the early learning programs that are listed on that slide that was put up. We can go back. Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, okay, let me go back to that. Here we go. Yeah, so the Office of Teaching and Learning, you can see it's the entire Early Learning Services division. There is this grant program, After School Community Learning Grant Program, that is currently not funded. I mean, it just simply exists in statute. The governor is proposing to fund it, and so assuming that we agree with that and end up funding it, We will evaluate that and see what we do with your proposal. But if we do that, that program would then move over as well. And so it really is the early learning services that are the programs from MD that move over. Those programs, I should note, are in the jurisdiction of Children and Families for the most part, except that a few of those are funded through the formula, and so they will end up passing through this committee. But otherwise, they're within the jurisdiction of Children and Families as opposed to this committee.
Thank you, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, any other questions? Yes, I've got a list. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. By the way, Representative Altendorf is in the Elections Commission. Yes. So
I realized that once I said it, I'm like, wait a minute. I know she's in the other room.
Yeah.
Working hard. They're working hard over there.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't even know, 15 years ago or something, I actually was the commissioner of the Department of Employee Relations, which no longer exists. We did the opposite. I actually eliminated the agency, but I did it through similarly to what you're doing, essentially moving divisions into MMB, health, admin, et cetera, so that agency no longer exists. I do agree that human services is too big. And we've known that for a long time. And so I actually think this is a good idea, frankly. It's a reorg more than, anything. But, pulling these different departments out, I think, makes sense. My question to your representative is what is the general FTE? I mean, what numbers are we actually looking at? And then I just want to make one more comment. Given all the empty office space and all the work at home and everything else, I hope that the reorg team looks at, not building a new building somewhere. So. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Pinto.
I'm actually going to have Assistant Commissioner Bailey respond to that if I can, Madam Chair.
Yeah, Chair and Representative, thank you so much for the question and comment. I'll start with the second one first. Office space is quite a conversation, obviously. Mm-hmm. I think it's something that we've talked about and will continue working on as a part of the transition process. So we have, I think if we count sort of the what is in the crux of the bill of the core programs moving, we're talking about 1,000 FTEs. It's pretty, as to your point about the Department of Human Services, pretty significant mm-hmm. Size of employees. The vast majority of those employees are with the Department of Human Services. And then obviously there's some minute functions that are kind of the next largest. And then the area within your jurisdiction here of the committee is about 40 to 50 FTEs.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, follow up.
Thank you. Maybe another couple comments. I'm not sure you need $7 million to do this. You could put it on a team, but, that is what it is. So we didn't get any money to do it originally. But that was under plenty, so very different, world back then. So budget-wise. So, I think this is needed and has been needed for a long time, breaking up human services, and that's what you're essentially talking about doing. So I wish you the best of luck. I also understand your amendment. Ideally, you'd have a little more flexibility in a reorg, but it's going to be a lot easier to do if the employees are not concerned about their positions. Consolidating happens through attrition, it happens through promotion, it happens through there's ways to do what you need to do as you get further into the process without, people concerned about their positions in the short term. So it still can be done. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Thanks. Representative Anderson. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, my mask got tied up in my silly earrings. But thank you, Representative Pinto, and everyone for all of your work that you put into this bill. The why is correct, and a tremendous amount of work has gone into it, and I deeply appreciate it. I also really appreciate the A7 amendment. It answers a lot of the questions that I'm hearing from my constituents. So thank you for the work that was done on that. I am hearing from a lot of questions from constituents of mine, and I don't know how you knew this, but I was going to ask Assistant Commissioner Burnham to come up and talk about what I'm hearing a lot of questions from constituents of mine who work under Part C through MDE and are wondering about what it'll look like if their position is going from MDE to DHS. And their positions, they aren't people who work at MDE. They are people who work for districts and work directly in for districts serving our littlest learners and future MPS students or students in other districts. So what would it look like for these educators and early interventionists who work for districts if the oversight is moved from MDE to this new office? And I realize they said DHS, which is whatever this new acronym will be that is not at the top of my head. So I'm wondering, Commissioner, if you can talk a little bit about what that would look like for those employees who are employed by districts.
Ms. Burnham.
Madam Chair, thank you. That's a great question, Representative Jordan. And the goal of this, throughout the transition and throughout all the public engagement and engagement of partners, is that the local services will not look different. So they will continue to do their jobs at the local level as they do today. So we want to have these ongoing conversations and talk with your constituents to just tell them that the goal of this transition is not to change those services because they're working well, and we don't want to change something that is already working. So it's just the state level administration that will move, not the local level.
Thank you, Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. So what would any changes look like for families that are receiving these services from districts? Also no change?
Assistant Commissioner Burnham.
Madam Chair, also the goal is no changes for providers or families. The goal is to better coordinate services for families.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one last question. Again, thank you so much, Assistant Commissioner. What is being done to assure those goals of either no change or better service are being met? What is going into that to ensure that that is happening to achieve those goals?
Assistant Commissioner Burnham.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think ongoing and a really intentional communication feedback loop between the families, between the service providers, just to reiterate the goal of this transition is to have those local services remain as the same. So it's really going to be meeting with folks as needed and as often, hearing, listening, making sure they have a voice at the table.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, team that's bringing this to us. And I know that it is a whole team and so many people that have participated and talked about this change. And when I was listening to the testimony and thinking about what we were doing, as we often do, we kind of think of metaphors or stories that kind of illustrate what I think is happening. So in our family, many years ago, we were doing a family, multi-family events. So there was aunts and uncles and cousins. I had my three kids. We were all going to this play. And when we got there, we were passing out tickets, and we had one extra ticket. And we're looking like, why do we have an extra ticket? Did we buy too many tickets? And it's like, no, we bought enough tickets. And we were looking like, okay, wait a minute, is somebody missing? It was my daughter, my 9-year-old daughter. We left at home. That happens. She still remembers. But what we're doing and why this works is that right now we've got DHS provides these services, and they do home visiting. MDE provides these services, and we fund child care this way and that way. And they say, yeah, we braid together all of this money from all of these different services. But what we don't know is who we are leaving out, because we have not coordinated. And we cannot coordinate it in the system that we have right now. So just as, you know, that, and this is what Representative Anderson is saying, the same thing. And so that's why just sometimes your bureaucracy has to change, because it's not meeting the needs of the families. It's not meeting the needs of the youth. It's not meeting the needs of our youngest learners in Minnesota. So, there's a cost to making change, and it needs to be done. And I know some of the great people passionately involved that are going to do the right thing. Right now, this fractured service, the people that pay the cost are the families. They're the ones that have form after form after form that they have to fill out.
They don't know who's supposed to give them the service that they need for their kids. We don't know who it is either because we can't talk to each other. So this is a change that we need to do going forward. And I so deeply appreciate the work that everybody has done to make this happen. And I know it's a long time coming, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. The goal here is to try to vote by 11:20 so that we can go 11:25 so that we can make it to our next bill. So I have Representative Clardy and then Representative Cresha. So Representative Clardy.
Thanks for bringing this to us. And I really appreciate that you will be having a transition office to deal with a lot of the issues that we're talking about right now. Kindergarten's tricky. And so my question's kind of focusing in that area, and I'm looking at like maybe even the statewide pre-assessment that we're doing and trying to figure out which department that would fall under or how the relationship would be between the pre-K and then the K-2, that type of thing. Could you, and just kind of some discussions that you've had around that, if you could speak to that, I'd really appreciate it.
Assistant Commissioner Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a great question, and some of you may know that has been probably one of the top priorities for me as an educator and a staff member at MDE for the almost 15 years I've worked there, is that transition from the early childhood system to the early elementary system. So we are having those intentional conversations, and that will be part of the ongoing planning process, is to make sure that bridge remains built between this new agency and our MDE folks. So by moving those early learning services programs into the new agency, we will ensure that there's still that bridge and those staff that coordinate, plan together, and ensure that transitions for families as they go from one system to the other remains as smooth as it can be and as coordinated as it can be. And that's really a good, strong priority and purpose of this new agency, is to stay. And I, as long as I'm there, can reassure that transition and that connection to the K-12 system is strong.
Representative Clardy, follow up?
No. Thank you. Chair.
Representative Cresha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. So there's a lot to do in this. I've looked at things in the past. I don't think there's any disagreement that the need is not clear. So I'm just going to go through a series of questions. Our job as legislators is to try to put the most objections forward to try to make sure that we address things. So a couple of things as I look at this. I look at the path of this. Is this going to go through state gov and also judiciary? Is that planned?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Lee Cresha. Yes to state gov, and it already went through judiciary. And state gov is scheduled for Tuesday, I believe.
Thank you. Representative Cresha.
Thank you. And so just to give you a heads up, with the additions you added in line 3.6 and the data practices, it probably would be worth having the conversation of judiciary. I certainly would be in favor of re-referral to go back to judiciary, because unless you're making substantive changes that you've already talked about.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks, Lee Cresha. So what passed the judiciary, if you look on page, hold on one second here, basically there was already language that passed through judiciary on bottom of page 7, top of page 8.
Yep.
And to be really blunt, it's very, very broad language. So quite a bit more, I think, aggressive in the view of some folks. But we talked at the time about the need to ratchet it back somewhat and have it more focused. And so what's in the A7 is actually coming out of that. So essentially it's already been blessed by judiciary, and then this is a narrower version. And so I've been in touch with Chair Becker Finn and also with Lead Scott about it. So I think we're in good shape on that.
Okay. Representative Cresha.
Thank you. Thank you for that answer. I appreciate that. So a couple of other things that I think about and what we've heard, this will be disruptive. It has to be disruptive. We're moving from a system, of status quo to chaos back to status quo, because we have to restructure this. We have to re-engineer this. And I look at that. We're just not changing letterhead. Let me just say it that way. And so there's a lot there. So a couple of things that I'll bring up. I understand the need to give certainty to the people and the positions they have. However, I think that certainty to the best that it can be done will be done with the current supervisors, managers, directors, and all that. We are talking about, as legislators, or from my standpoint, I'm talking about how we interface with a future commissioner and a future agency on behalf of our people. So I'm not thinking about that certainty for the people that are there, because there's new possibilities, right? New jobs, new promotions. Some people will probably move on. That happens. But I do want to make sure that we're very clear, and that we as legislators give the autonomy and the clarity to get through this disruption without roadblocks. My fear is that as people are going through the change and as things are getting hard, because there's a line in here, the governor at any time can throw the red flag and say, well, we're not going to do this, and just send a report back to the ranking members, or we're not going to do things. I actually think we have to go through it and get this thing rebuilt. I think that, and people, none of us like change. There will be resistance to change. And so my biggest thing is, I'm actually saying, how do we make sure this is as disruptive as we can be, so that we can get to a better, more functioning system? So that's one thing. So I mean, there's things that I've been through, restructures. We've all been through them. I mean, there will be territorial fights. There is going to be fights about which services we keep, which ones we don't. This is the human side of it. People have passion. They have ownership and all of that. So I want to make sure, as a legislator, I'm saying to the people that are going to do this, we got your back, and I know it's going to be really, really hard, because the opportunity to get this right far outweighs the opportunity to just change letterhead. And I'm just being very upfront about that. I mean, you will have to resolve conflict between the three new departments. I suspect Mr. Uni will not be coming up here unless he takes on the new government liaison for this, will not be arguing on this behalf of resources, because whoever's in his position, or if it's him, he'll be arguing on behalf of his area. So all of that is going to create this new system that we're going to have to allow break so that we can rebuild it. So, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and tell you, is this good or bad? It's necessary. And in times of necessary, it needs to be disruptive, and it's going to hurt, but it's going to be better. If we don't, we're just going to have more layers of what we're already doing today, and then we're going to see future agents or future administrations attacking it and cutting it, or going after it or growing it. I want this to be so good that it's undeniable that a future administrator can say, you know what, I'm really glad we did that. I know it was super painful, but the state of Minnesota is better off for it. And that's going to be disruptive. So those are my comments.
Thank you, Representative Grisha. With that, Representative Pinto, final comments.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thanks all for the discussion. Thanks especially, Representative Grisha, for those final comments. I thought they're really, really helpful. I want to just say briefly that I maybe would push back a little bit on your use of the word chaos or that concept, just in the sense I want to make sure we're really clear that you've got an organization, DHS, that has a division. If you sort of think about an organization, what's really happening here is that division is being started as a new agency, and then an office within MDE that works at least as much, certainly the programs work at least as much in early learning with programs within Children and Family Services at DHS as they do with the rest of MDE. So what's happening is that you're really having those existing relationships that right now result in a lot of fragmentation for families and kids being put in the same place, so which is not to understate the challenge. And I really appreciate the history of Representative Anderson. I'd like to talk to you more, of course, to draw on this. But just to say, I think we shouldn't overstate, though, how disruptive. It certainly will be disruptive, but I don't want to overstate that. I want to make sure we're really clear about what's really happening here, is it's really a spinoff with folks who are already working with them quite a bit joining in. I guess I also wanted to note that some of the points that I've heard, even Representative Creasy referenced having the opportunity to pause for the governor, I have heard from colleagues of ours who are concerned, hey, there is a transition period. We want to make sure we're doing it right. And it may be in the course of the transition we say, wait a second, what we think is true right now, we might think is different in a year, just because there might be some changes have to be made. So we want to make sure there's flexibility. I think that the proposal that's here before us provides that flexibility, does provide the necessary funding to make it happen. Again, I'd like to follow up with you, Representative Anderson, on that. But I've heard also concerns from members. There is a need for more funding to make sure it works well. So we'll talk about that. But overall, I think there's a really balanced approach for the transition. And I love what I've heard from members about the need to make this happen, and let's do it. Thanks so much to all.
And Madam Chair, 20 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so Representative Pinto, I want to just go deeper with the understanding, not to counter what you said. When I use the word chaos, this is how I see it. And we've talked behind the scenes and we continue to. Yeah. There will come a point as they're going through this new disruptive when everyone's going to say, whoa, let's go back. This is too much. What I'm saying at that point is we need to get them to push forward. So when we talk about this, that's the chaos that I talk about, is when everyone's going to go, this doesn't work because it was safer back there, right? The thin ice is up there, not ahead of me. So we can talk more about this, but I really appreciate you bringing that through. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. With that, members, I move that House File 2320 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Children's and Families. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. House File 2320 is amended.
Thanks, Chair and members.
On its way.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you all.
As we move around here, we've got House File 2619. before us. Let's settle in again here. Representative Pryor, would you like to move House File 2619 before the committee?
So moved.
Thank you, Matt. Representative Pryor. Representative Pryor moves 2619 before the committee with the intention to lay it over for future inclusion in an education finance bill. With that, too, I believe the author has an amendment labeled A2. Representative Pryor would like to move the A2 amendment.
Yes, so moved.
Thank you. A2 amendments before us. Representative Stevenson, would you like to briefly describe the A2 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The A2 just adds some more detail about having paraprofessionals in the classroom and how that impacts the ratios.
Thank you so much, Representative Stevenson. With that, members, any questions on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The A2 amendment's adopted. Representative Stevenson, take it away.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, class size matters. Too many students in a classroom makes individualized attention virtually impossible. And that lack of attention affects student outcomes, both academic and in life. Small class sizes have long-term benefits for students, particularly in the early years of education. Research shows that students with two or more years of small classes in elementary school scores score higher on tests in middle and high school and are more likely to graduate and more likely to take the ACT or SAT and attend college. They are also healthier and eventually earn more, paying more taxes and relying less on the social safety net. These gains are stronger for students who come from groups that are traditionally disadvantaged in education, BIPOC and English learner students. Small class sizes also benefit educators, giving them more time to teach and to focus on students who need more help. Educators with small class sizes are typically less stressed and feel more satisfied in their jobs, meaning fewer of them leave the classroom before retirement. Fortunately, in too many school districts in Minnesota, class sizes are getting bigger, not smaller. Starting in 2024, my bill, House File 2619, addresses this issue by increasing state funding on the formula 20% in Section 1 of the bill and dedicating half of that money each year to reducing class sizes statewide. This is in Section 2 of the bill. A 20% increase in education spending may seem like a lot, and it is, but when we, particularly when we consider the legislature's use to considering a request to increase the formula of 1, 2, maybe 3%. But this is more a reflection of how we failed to adequately fund our education system for more than 20 years. Adjusted for inflation, the state spends less on education today than it did when I graduated from high school in 2002. We are more than 20 years behind. The bill outlines minimum class size ratios the districts must meet, starting no more than 17 students per teacher in grades K through 3, 21 students per teacher in grades 4 through 9, and 23 students per teacher in grades 10 through 12. This is all in Section 2. This has all been done in Minnesota before, and we can do it again. The legislature saw the value in well-balanced class sizes and mandated specific ratios back in the 1990s. The bill does allow for local control as well, and that's also in the bill. We're hearing alarming stories from students, parents, and teachers about student mental health, managing terrible ratios of students to adults in classrooms. If we can do it correctly, we can see real results. Class size matters, and this is a bill designed to make sure we're investing in the place where we can make the most difference. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. With that, we have three testifiers, and we do have a hard stop at noon. So just keep that in mind, folks, and this bill is being laid over. First up, we have Dr. Killian. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Youkim, and members of the committee and Representative Stevenson. My name is Dr. Justin Killian, and it's my pleasure to work for the 86,000 members of Education Minnesota, many of whom couldn't be here to testify for you today because they are in their classrooms right now, which are overcrowded and underfunded. Representative Stevenson did a good job of tying this back to the decades of divestment by state and federal government, but I just wanted to add a little bit to this and expand on how class size really does matter for one of the issues that we've talked a lot about this session, and that's literacy. I've sat through a lot of testimony in both chambers, and I've watched a lot of people get up and talk about class size, and we've had a lot of stories about how much it will cost, and we've had a lot of stories about how hard it will be. But what we haven't had a lot of stories about is how we cannot afford not to do this and how vital it is for our students and our educators if we're serious about actually closing that reading achievement gap in Minnesota. I worked with a member this previous summer, ironically, on teacher burnout, and she came to help us build some professional development to help our members who are very stressed. She's a kindergarten teacher in the South Metro. Due to COVID, due to resignations, due to people being sick, she had 37 kindergartners and no para. She was in a room by herself every day with 37 5-year-olds who needed to learn how to tie their shoes. They needed to learn how to read. They needed to learn how to count. They needed to learn how to use scissors. She was alone. And she made all kinds of excuses about how she was able to do it, and she liked doing it. But that is a lot of 5-year-olds to be in charge of by yourself, and that's unsustainable. Class size is one of the most studied variables in education research, but there's also a lot of confusion about how that research gets deployed. This is often due to research methodology that people don't spend a lot of time thinking about, and we shouldn't do that here. But I will tell you that if you look deeply at the class size research, you will see that reducing class sizes closes literacy gaps in the early years, and we've also confirmed that students who were placed in smaller classes in their primary grades continue to show improved academic achievement, even if their class sizes grow later in their education. We know that reducing class size will be hard. We know that it'll be difficult. That's why there's flexibility in this bill to allow districts to do what works best for them. But we will not stop teacher attrition, and we will not improve reading or math in the state of Minnesota if we keep allowing teachers to have this many students in their classroom. Thank you for your time, and you're going to hear from two of our members now.
Thank you, Dr. Killian. Next up, Greta Callahan and then Maria Lee Selmer. Go ahead, state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Greta Callahan, and I'm a kindergarten teacher on release from the Minneapolis Public Schools, currently serving as president of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers Teacher Chapter. I'm also the mother of a student in the district, and I'm here today to testify in support of House File 2619. And I want to make it very clear that I'm not here to talk about who we're going to blame. I'm here to talk about the solutions. The most important resources in Minnesota classrooms are time and trusting relationships between students and educators, and this bill will give us both. It would set aside one half of any increase to the state's per pupil formula to improve the ratios of educators to students, and it sets the maximum class sizes. Every teacher will tell you that when class sizes get smaller or student to educator ratios improve, good things happen. My first year is teaching in Minneapolis. I taught at the poorest school in our district, with 100% of my students qualifying for free and reduced lunch. Many were homeless or highly mobile. I had between 27 and 30 students in my first years, 27 5-year-olds who were never in preschool, and you're responsible for getting them to read is no small feat, let alone adding the struggles of poverty on top of that. Our union fought hard for class size caps in schools like mine. And eventually, we had one on a temporary basis. The next few years, I had a class size cap of 18 students. It was night and day what I was able to give my kids and what they were able to receive and gain in the classroom. My coworkers and I would think of our students in the years prior and just felt so much heartbreak for what they should have and could have had. With smaller class sizes, we could differentiate instruction, make lessons more engaging. We could adapt to the many personalities that our kids have and create opportunities for all of our students to shine. Joy comes back and academic achievement increases when we're set up to succeed. But unfortunately, most students in Minnesota are learning in a classroom with too many other students, which affects the quality of education they're receiving. As the speaker before me said, 37 kindergartners in one class. It's not about me trying to teach 37 kids. It's about 37 kids who need to learn in that class. They deserve that individualized attention, differentiated instruction, small groups, the ability to build those relationships. That's impossible when we have kids literally sitting on wall heaters in our classrooms because there isn't the space to provide for more chairs. Overcrowded classrooms are also driving the teacher shortage. I'm putting that in quotes, which has been reported in more than 8 of 10 school districts. And I've watched this firsthand in Minneapolis. We've never been paid enough, but now the intrinsic rewards are also dwindling thanks to so many students in one classroom. And requiring teachers to educate too many students in a day is creating conditions where no one is feeling successful. Students aren't reaching their full potential. Teachers leave the profession, and this in turn creates more turnover and instability in schools, which creates emotionally unsafe conditions for our students. It's a vicious cycle, and we're trying to stop it. Teachers' unions have been raising these issues at the bargaining table for years, always at the protests of negotiators on the other side who believe this is should stay the prerogatives of management. They're simply wrong. Our schools are not businesses. Our students are not market share. They're humans who deserve a world-class education. You may hear some people say that there just isn't physical space for this. Let's not get distracted. In most cases, we're not asking for more classrooms. We're asking for more support. Our kids need smaller ratios of teachers to students. Co-teaching works. Adding additional educators helps to reduce that ratio, giving students the care they deserve while minimizing the need to seek out an additional building. And you may also hear complaints that this policy is unworkable because there aren't enough teachers available to fill all the jobs it would create. That makes no sense. The State Teacher Licensing Board recently reported that over 38% of all Minnesota teachers are not currently teaching. That's a choice. This means there are plenty of teachers in Minnesota, but there's a shortage of people willing to work for the pay and working conditions offered by Minnesota school districts. It's not credible to say we can't improve our working conditions because of the teacher shortage when we have a teacher shortage because of our working conditions. It's time for the legislature to step in, break this cycle, alongside those of us on the ground floor who knows what's best for kids. If you can improve the ratio of educators to students, you're giving our kids the time, care, and attention they deserve. You're giving them the room to grow and make mistakes and learn from them. You're giving them room for students to have one-on-one attention when they're struggling so no one falls behind. You're bringing back trust and joy to Minnesota classrooms. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next up, we have Maria Leigh Selmer, who has a beautiful little distraction for us with her. So thank you. Go ahead and please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Maria Leigh Selmer. I am an elementary school teacher in the Roseville Area Schools, and I am vice president of my local union, Education Minnesota Roseville. This is my 17th year as an educator. Throughout these 17 years, I have worked with our primary age students, most notably teaching third grade and first grade. As a parent myself, I think about whether my families are getting what they need and deserve in their education. I then think about the makeup of my class. In the beginning years of my teaching career, I would typically have a classroom of 18 to 22 first graders. First grade is a big year for students because they are in the beginning stages of learning to read, a life skill that is a make or break on their future and quality of life. Since this is a critical time in a student's learning, I also had the help of an education support professional, or ESP, in my classroom. We lasted so long, I'm sorry. No. I also had the help of an educational support professional, or ESP, in my classroom, so that I can provide much-needed differentiation instruction to my students. I wish that I could say that all of my 17 years had classes like this, but unfortunately, I would see my class list get longer and longer each year. One year, I had 33 students in my class. She's not happy about it either.
Outraged, really outraged, yeah.
I didn't even have matching furniture to fit the number of students in one room. This year, I've had between 26 to 28 first graders in my classroom without much needed help of an ESP. My husband, a middle school teacher, has approximately 34 to 38 students per class. The needs of my students are significantly greater than 17 years ago. Currently, I have 5 students who receive special education services, 5 multilingual learners with direct services, and 7 with indirect services. 6 students that have significant learning needs that are not currently identified as needing services, but are in the process of being assessed. And finally, the various social, emotional, mental health needs of my students. With the sub shortage, it is not uncommon for teachers to absorb their colleagues' classrooms. In the last few years, I've had between 55 to 60 first graders in my class. Parents all over the state have seen firsthand what their child needs when we were doing distance learning. Due to these years of interrupted learning, we must consider what educators need in order to lessen the existing learning gap that is now widened due to the pandemic. It is nearly impossible for me as a veteran teacher to properly intervene and meet the multitude of needs of my students. I am working under conditions with limited support professionals, alongside special education managers with overloaded caseloads, social workers with long wait lists to meet students, school psychologists who can't keep up with assessments, and a school full of exhausted teachers on the next wave of burnout, because these past few years, we have seen waves of burnt out teachers who have left. Taking a statewide stance on limiting class sizes will not only allow for me to better meet the needs of my students, it will also keep my colleagues from cycling through questions that we are afraid to answer. The questions I have personally asked include, how on earth can I differentiate for 33 first graders? How can I console multiple students crying while others are raising their hands for help and I can't get to them? My colleague is out. How can I change my instruction last minute that will engage 58 first graders? And the worst question of all, is my job worth it anymore if I have to work so much harder with less support? Limiting class sizes will meet the academic, behavioral, and social emotional needs of students, create a better learning environment for classrooms and school-wide, and help with educator retention. I urge the committee to consider implementing statewide class size caps so that students, families, and educators can have a workable educational experience.
Thank you so much for your testimony and for being here today. With that, members, we have one other public testimony person signed up for public testimony, Deb Henton.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, it's not fair to follow that beautiful baby, but here goes. I am Deb Henton, the Executive Director of MASA, and I am speaking on behalf of those members in my organization and also AMSD, MSBA, MASSP, MESPA, C, and MREA. There are some areas of this bill and A2 amendment I would like to address. When we saw the increase of the formula allowance to $8,236 in fiscal year 2024, we were delighted, as our school districts have been underfunded for the past 20 years or more. The fixed ratio, we noted that the legislation, in this legislation, 8% of the basic revenue must be dedicated to fixed class size ratios unless otherwise negotiated, or with adding another staff person to each classroom that are above the ratios. The fixed ratios would make it difficult for districts to assume an influx of students. Here's one example. In Columbia Heights, they welcomed 400 new students this school year alone. Here's what I heard from other school leaders about the impact of this legislation. Sleepy Eye, the superintendent wonders if paraprofessionals that are funded via Title I special education are shared between classrooms could be utilized to come into compliance with this legislation. If those individuals do not qualify to assist with reducing class size ratios, they would need to hire 21 paraprofessionals in K-12. In addition, they would need to add 3 elementary teachers and at the high school several more. Hutchinson would need 132 new paraprofessionals at roughly a cost of $3.1 million. Additionally, they would need to add 32 teachers at a projected cost of $2.2 million. Renville County West, they would need three additional paraprofessionals and also three teachers at a cost of about $165,000, and they would need another specialist in the elementary schools, and their total cost would be roughly around $190-some thousand. Minnetonka, they have 11,000 students, and they would need a paraprofessional in essentially every classroom. Minnetonka has 375 classrooms. This would require Minnetonka to hire 375 paras at a cost of roughly $11 million. With their 11,000 students, the superintendent assumed they are 1/70th of the state student population. This would mean that this bill would cost almost $900 million. All of this assumes Minnetonka could find 375 new employees who meet the steep requirements listed and want to be paraprofessionals, an area they cannot already fill. As for additional teachers, there is no space in any of their elementary schools to add in the roughly conservative figure of 40 additional teachers that they would need, which signals the potential need for bonds to build more schools, and they would not be the only school district in the state that would need that. Finally, I'll move to St. Michael Albertville. Some of you have heard about their situation in other bills. They would need a total of 289 more paraprofessionals at a cost of roughly $11.6 million and an additional 58.5 teachers at a cost of $4.4 million. So I'll wrap it up and say in brief, this solution is very costly. It's unrealistic in a time of a critical labor shortage. We believe that determining class size is a managerial right, and we encourage the use of the collective bargaining process. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I know I stand before you, and hopefully a wonderful weekend. So thank you.
Thank you. Members, we're going to go right to questions. We have about 10 minutes. And reminder, this bill's being laid over, and we have a hard stop at noon. Members, questions? Representative Kreshaw.
I can go to the end if there's any other ones, or I can wrap up and we can go home.
Representative Fire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this bill is talking about reality, because we're not talking about what schools can do right now. We're talking about what schools should be doing and what our state should be doing in terms of funding education. And this bill lays it out, what the need is and the way to make sure that every child has a world-class education now and into the future. I know we're at a deep, deep hole, and it's going to take a while to get out, but this bill lays out the pathway to do it.
Thank you, Representative Fryer. Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Stevenson, for bringing this bill. I think this bill makes a lot of sense. You know, I've talked to different educators about this bill, and I will say, like, it gives educators like hope and joy, which is not something I'm seeing a lot right now. And so I think this could be an important lifeline. I had some questions about some of the concerns that were raised by the last testifier, and I'm wondering if you or someone else could talk to this. So, you know, there was a question around, and I think, you know, a real concern we heard about, you know, Columbia Heights got an influx, I believe, of refugee students in a year. How would schools be able to kind of deal with the influxes that we know happen within a year? And then what is the outcome or what's the kind of accountability that happens if a school is not in compliance with these ratios?
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, yes. I also was struck by some of the comments that were made there about the number of staff that would need to be hired in a district. And I thought, to Representative Pryor's point, just shows what we need to do rather than being a reason not to do it. It's like, okay, we're way behind. We need a lot more staff. To your point about the influx, keep in mind that the bill allows a lot of local control and envisions school districts working with education professionals, you know, the educators, to determine a plan to reduce class sizes. So those specific issues that come up in specific districts would be addressed on a local basis. You know, there's not any penalty in the bill, to your last question, but we're trying to provide the resources necessary to accomplish the goal.
Thank you, Representative Sensenmura. Follow up.
No, thank you.
And seeing no, Representative Hill.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson, for bringing the bill. I think this is an important conversation to have. Recently, having hosted a birthday party for a six-year-old that included five six-year-olds for 90 minutes, we barely got out the door. And so thank you to our folks that provided testimony, and the conditions that they described are real. They're ongoing, and this is the conversation we need to be having about the future of Minnesota. So thank you, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Representative Hill. With that, I have Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Stevenson, for the bill. So just my quick comments. Great, Ed Minnesota's trying to take the collective bargaining back to the state level out of our local schools. We see these bills from time to time. The reality of this, though, members, if this gets in, it's going to constrain all the other budget side. It just simply, how many teachers, how many classes won't we be able to offer because we're just increasing numbers? And we're doing that at our level. The fact of the matter is everyone's talking class sizes in these schools. You've all been in your schools as well as I have. It's best that the teachers and the collective bargaining units conversations work best in those schools. They are working through what they know the best. So, I mean, my just quick back of the envelope numbers is this would be about a $3 to $4 billion ask. We have a $3 to $4 billion ask for pensions. If we put a 5 and 5 out there, and then you start to look at the family paid leave and all that, we're out of money. We're just simply out of money. So I get it. We're trying to have this conversation. People can go back and say they fought for ratios. But if this goes forward, I think it's going to just tie our hands onto what we really could do and how we could really help schools. So good luck, Ed Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Christian. Actually, since bargaining came up, I have to toss it over to Representative Jordan because she does have a bill to talk about that.
I do, Madam Chair, and right now in statute, the class sizes are not one of the subjects of bargaining. Student-to-staff ratios are not currently a subject of bargaining, and so if we want to make sure that educators have the ability to bargain over staff sizes, we need to allow them to do that. This is a real problem. We've all heard it, and this is something that, this is a solution. So I really want to thank Representative Stevenson for actually proposing a solution from the concerns that he's, I'm sure, hearing from educators in his district, because I'm hearing from the educators in his district that class sizes are an issue. And it's not just Representative Stevenson's district. In my district, where class sizes are an issue, they're an issue across the state. And so making sure that we have the tools to do this is something that we need to put on the table. Representative Stevenson is proposing money on the table. I propose just allowing educators to actually bargain over class sizes, which is currently not in the scope of bargaining for educators in this state. So I think we need to get real about this. We need to put solutions on the table, and Representative Stevenson has done just that. So thank you, Representative Stevenson, for doing so.
Thank you. Representative Stevenson, final comments.
Madam Chair, Representative Jordan's right. I am hearing from educators in my district, most notably my wife, who teaches at Coon Rapids High School, where her class sizes are above 30 in the best case scenario, you know, 7 above what this bill is shooting for. That doesn't work. It's causing huge harms to our students. It's causing huge harms to our teachers who are leaving the profession at record rates. We need to get this down. Minnesota is the education state. This is why we have the great quality of life we have here, because we have an economy that's diverse and prosperous based on having a highly educated workforce. We have to fund that in order to make it work, and that's what this bill is about. I ask for the committee support.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. And with that, we will lay over House File 2619 as amended for possible inclusion in an education finance bill. Members, we have a busy week next week. We're meeting Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday in our regular room at our regular time. And on Friday, we will be back here starting at 1 o'clock in room, and also Capital 120, but 1 o'clock. So with that, members, have a good week. Oh, Representative Grisha.
So just cover. So I know we have a busy week, looking forward. So our next Friday, are you, I know we have it from 1 to 4. What are you, is that the full bill you're looking at us bringing up?
Oh, Representative Grisha, I know we didn't get a chance to talk about it Monday. So. No, that's just, schedule's already been posted.
Got it. We just have, getting through what we have.
Yes.
Thank you.
Exactly. Thank you. With that, we are adjourned.